I'll talk about galaxy bimodality that we heard a little bit about and how it's connected to this gas supply processes, hot and cold, connected to the IGM and ICM. This is my outline. I'll start with a brief summary of the observations very quickly, trying to convince you there is a striking evidence for a given scale in galaxies, very pronounced one, in many different ways. And then three theoretical discussions. One about shock heating versus cold flows. This is the main point of my talk here. The clustering scale, which is an independent thing, and a summary of some feedback processes, mostly discussed today, and some more. Put them together, I'll try to speculate on what is the origin of these observational features, which I'll call, in a very general way, bimodality. But I mean more than just bimodality. So what do we see? We see a bimodality or transition at a specific scale, stellar mass of 3 times 10 to the 10 solar masses, roughly, just below M star, which correspond to a halo mass of 6 times 10 to the 11 solar mass, roughly. And in very broad brush description, below this, what we have is disks, blue, star forming, low metallicity, low surface brightness as you go down with luminosity, M over L decreasing with mass along what I call a fundamental line of LSBs and dwarf galaxies, and they're mostly found in the field, which I will associate in some sense with small halos. Above this scale, what we have typically are spheroids, which are red, old populations, high metallicity, high and constant surface brightness, M over L increasing now with mass from the critical mass and up. There's a fundamental plane describing those spheroids, and they're typically in clusters, which I will in some way associate with massive halos. And also, surprisingly, these are the ones where we see the AGNs mostly. 3 points. One, here, some of the galaxies, small ones, are very, very blue in excess of the models, and they really require bursty star formation. We do see at higher redshift something like big blue galaxies, maybe the Scuba sources and others, which indicate early star formation in big objects. And finally, we have this extremely red object at redshift 1 to, and around 1 and today, which also need early star formation, but then a shutdown of star formation to very abruptly to allow this. Let me quickly run through the data. So the mass functions show that the red dominate above this scale and the blue dominate below that. This is from Sloan. The bulge to this ratio from the concentration index by Kaufman et al. From Sloan show you that in this scale, indeed, you have spheroids above the scale and a sharp transition to disks below this scale. The surface brightness is flat here and is going down. And again, the magic scale is 3 times 10 to the 10 solar masses. The metallicity is doing similar thing. There's a band around the same scale, also from Sloan. The age of the population is really bimodal. Again, from Kaufman et al., you see that by two ways, spectral ways of estimating ages of populations, what you see is that the young populations are below here, and above this is a jump, a gap, and there's the old populations. And this is seen in those two indicators. There's bimodality in color from Sloan. There's the red sequence, there's the blue sequence, and there's the gap in between. This bimodality in age and in color is really correlated with the environment, which may be related to being in a group in a big halo or in a smaller halo. And you see this is the low density environment where you see the blue sequence mostly, and this is the high density environment where you see the red sequence. Strong correlation of these features with the environment. And the point again is that there is a correlation between being in a high density environment and being in a big halo. It's not a one-to-one, of course, relationship, but there is a correlation like this. And I would mainly end up claiming that it's the halo mass, which is the major variable that determines the two sequences. And the same story is true at high redshift, at different redshifts from COBOL 17. Low redshift, high redshift, you see the same kind of bimodality, roughly the same scale. Another interesting feature, also showing the same scale here, is comparing the luminosity function with the knee at L star and the mass function of halos. And you see that you can measure it at one point, but you have big problems in the bright end and a big problem in the faint end, which you want to understand. And the scale here is again the same scale if you want halo mass of a little below 10 to the 12 solar masses. The same thing is seen when you do the conditional luminosity function, in this case from 2DF, assuming lambda CDM halos, and you see a minimum in M over L at the same scale, 6, 7 times 10 to the 11 solar masses, and M over L going up in towards the clusters here and towards smaller objects. And finally, this AGN business, if you look at this spectral plane, the idea is that if you are below this red line, the emission lines come from stars, and if you are above here, these are AGNs, and the conclusion is that the low-mass emission galaxies are almost all star formers, but once you go up in mass, above the critical scale here, then you start being dominated by AGNs. That's very interesting. So, this is, again, the summary. This scale corresponds to 3 times 10 to the 10 in the stars, corresponds to 6 times 10 to the 11 in halo mass, and if you want, 120 kilometers per second VL velocity. And we see the blue sequence, the red sequence, and this very blue, the very blue star formers, big ones at high redshift, and the extremely red object at high redshift. Now, this is really a robust scale there that we see in so many physics, and we want to understand it in very simple terms. So my talk will use some simulations, but it's really a toy model talk, try to put our hands on some of the basic ingredients. The standard picture of disk formation is due to Ries, Ostracare, and then White and Ries, and so on in halos. The idea is that you have a perturbation which expands and contracts to the VL equilibrium, and then there's gas and shock forms when the gas crosses, and there's a heating to the VL temperature. This is a basic assumption made and lying behind a lot of the models that people did, that all galaxies actually have hot gas to begin with, which then cools and make the disk in it, because then you cool radiatively from the inside out. There's a cooling radius in this standard picture, and there's then accretion into a disk in which you make stars and then maybe feedback. And the result is that cooling is allowed if the cooling time is shorter than free-fall time, then there's real accretion. This determines the cooling radius, and the mass when you compare those is 10 to the 12 to the 13 solar masses. And this is a robust result which really was with us for a long time, and I think was the basic help us basic understanding. But it's not really accurate, because if you look at this gas density VL temperature plot and you plot this cooling time equal freefall time, the idea is that if you have CDM fluctuations, then you make galaxies here and clusters here, because here you cannot cool on a free-fall time. You make dwarfs over there, that's not our point here. This upper bound is a little too big. We really need the bright end to be at low luminosity. This is one of the problems I showed you. So what a student of mine, Yuval Birnbaum, and myself set up to do was try to understand what really happened to these shocks. When do you have a shock and when you don't have the shock, using the physics of shock formation. And this is a spherical simulation we did. And in this spherical simulation, what you see are radial gas shells inside a halo, which you don't see, dark matter you don't see. Each gas shell goes to maximum expansion and turns around. It's a spherical collapse. And you see the classical picture. At the VL radius, there is shock heating, and you have hot gas at roughly the VL temperature, and everything is what you expected. There's a disk here put artificially by centrifugal force just to stop the collapse there. Now, if you go to lower masses, you see something very different. You see that below a given mass, and this was done with zero metallicity, so the mass is 10 to the 11. In reality, with metallicity, it's a little higher. What you see is that while there's shock at bigger scales, as long as the halo is smaller than 10 to the 11 solar masses or so, the collapse is cold and direct into the disk. There is no shock, simply because the cooling is too efficient here for the pressure to support a stable shock. And that's this new phenomenon. And what you have is cold infill, which I'll convince you is what really leads to the formation of most of the galaxies. Here is a picture from one of Kravtsov's simulation, and you really see for a relatively big halo that you do have a VL shock. You have shock heating. This is a disk forming. So it looks, again, like a standard picture. But if you look at this, at the smaller halo, much smaller than the critical mass, the VL radius is this one here, and everything here is caught. There is no shock heating, and the flow is completely cold into the disk for those small halos. And when you go back to the big object, you see that on top of this shock-heated gas, you still have those filaments coming in strong and possibly hitting the disks and creating star formation and so on. These filaments are riding on the filaments of the dark matter that feed this galaxy. And another picture from Volker Springer simulation of dark matter, just to illustrate how any halo is being fed by a very strong filamentary structure. You know, filaments are already moving in. And on these dense filaments, the gas flows in, and because of this high density in the filaments, the cooling time is short, and one cannot support, in this case, a stable shock. That's the key. Okay, you ride on this, you can make a shock here, but you cannot make shock here because the cooling time is so short along these flowing filaments. In a simulation by Karas et al., Neil and Ramil are here, you see very nicely how in the raw T diagram, you see all these components. In particular, you see those cold flow component here, and you see the hot component here. And very nicely, they have several galaxies here, several individual galaxies. As they evolve, you can think about it as infall into the high density regions, some of them do the heating, okay, and then cooling, and so there's no feedback here, so they're really cool. I would think that, I would try to convince you they're never cool actually in reality because of feedback. But here there are these cold flows, things really flow in as cold as they could be and remain cold as they come in. So how does it work? Well, the little theory that we developed, which actually we did it before we saw the simulation, before we ourselves did the simulation, was very simple. We asked, what do we need here to support a stable shock? The standard picture when you're doing stars is you assume a adiabatic case, a adiabatic index, derivative of P and rho, and you know that gamma bigger than 4/3 is stability. That's a textbook result. Well, here with cooling, Q, cooling rate, we introduce a new concept, gamma effective, which is the full derivative along the trajectory of P and rho. And if you put the energy conservation here, you actually find that it's the adiabatic gamma minus some ratio, which is really a cooling time here coming from E over Q, and a compression time here coming from rho over rho dot. And this is, and we put this number here just to get a nice result at the end. So the compression time is divided by rho over rho dot over here, which is actually the radius of the shock divided by the typical infall velocity there. And the cooling time is the usual cooling time in here. And when you do a perturbation analysis and try to ask about stability here, you move it a little bit and ask whether it will come back or collapse inwards, you find that once the cooling time is longer than this compression time, this ratio here with this parameter, then you have stability. So it's not just a dynamical time, it's a specific dynamical time, which is the time it takes the system to react to the infall and to have this increase of rho dot. In fact, you can see here very nicely that the lines are pretty parallel, the world lines. And this is what gives you rho dot over rho, which is a positive number. And this is what makes that as the gas cross the shocks, make the density increase, and the pressure try to balance the gravity that pushes everything down. And if the gas is stable here, then the shock can survive there. In fact, if you apply this little theorem about gamma effective, you really see that as you move in time, the moment it crosses this 10/7 critical number, indeed, that's the point where the shock becomes stable, it starts moving from the disk outwards and eventually settles at the veil radius. So this theory, this spherical theory, matches very well the spherical simulation. The critical mass for shock heating, we apply this criterion with temperature being like velocity squared, the VL relations for the halo, and we find a unique solution in cosmology for the critical mass where stability starts occurring. And based on the cooling curve, you get the exact results, but if you just approximate this slope here as t to the minus 1, you end up with these numbers, which already remind you the numbers we were talking about when we looked at observations. The critical masses for the halo was about this, the velocity and the temperature. And the more accurate results, if you try to look at them, tells you that as a function of redshift, the critical mass, and it's really depending on the metallicity and how you assume it evolves in time. I use the best average of everything that people know about how it, the IgM metallicity evolve and how the concentration of halos evolve. And the bottom line is that this mass, 6 times 10 to the 11, is pretty much constant with redshift. The velocity, on the other hand, corresponding to it, goes from 120 to almost 300 at redshift 5. You go back to the simulations of Karas et al., and you see exactly the same thing. It's really a gold mine, this paper that they submitted a few months ago, which you can discover everything you want on this issue. At any redshift, okay, on small masses below the critical mass, all the infill is cold. This is the fraction of cold infill in blue versus hot accretion in red. So everything is dominated by cold infill. As you go to this scale here, the red, the hot infill starts dominating. And as you can see, it's almost the same scale at all redshift. This is just an observational thing that's encouraging from a review paper about X-ray and ellipticals. You see that there's a scale corresponding to what we're talking about, which is in which you do see an excess of X-ray indicating hot dust in halos. The radius goes, well, the stability starts at the disk, at this scale, goes up and it becomes stable at the veil radius at this scale. And, well, let me skip this since the time is short. Just show you that as a function of VL mass, given the stability at the disk, this is the stability criterion being unity along this line. So this is at the VL radius and this is at the disk. The story is that as your halo starts small, it has a shock at the VL radius, but as it gets to 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 solar masses, of course, cooling kicks in, and you don't have a shock. There's no stable shock at the VL radius. But around 10 to the 12 solar mass, again, it develops a stable shock, which runs up and becomes a shock at the VL radius. And that's where you can make these galaxies, not here, not there. You can compare it to the M-star. Now M-star is the Preschecter M-star, the typical halo size. And you find that around redshift 1 or 2, they agree. So the conclusion is that at redshift above 1, most halos are below the shock scale, namely they're fed and built by cold strips. Let me introduce quickly two other scales which are independent but very much related. One is the clustering scale. We always thought about hydrodynamical arguments of cooling determining the scale, but some of us overlooked the trivial result that gravity and fluctuation also predict the same scale. And this is in the new language of halo distribution, occupation distribution, from the correlation function in Sloan. People can model it and get best fit with this kind of halo distribution occupancy. Namely, here is the mean number of objects of galaxies above a given magnitude limit in a halo of a given mass. And you see this trend, and let's say that when this n average is about 2, that's where you start getting groups. So you see that there's a scale, 10 to the 12, 10 to the 13 solar masses, where you start getting grouped objects. In fact, The same thing is reproduced in simulations when you look at subhalos inside halos. And in this paper by Kraftov et al., you see a very similar behavior of this HOD function with a very similar scale. Again, depending exactly on how you cut and what size you cut, you're not surprised that M star is the scale of groups. And above it, you start getting groups. This M star here is not M of stars, it's M star of press checker. Okay. This scale and a little smaller as you go to higher redshift. This is easy to understand. I won't go into great detail, but if you are much smaller than M star, namely you formed very early on, there was time for the big satellites to dynamical friction in and be swallowed, and you end up with about 1% of the mass of the big halo in your bigger satellite. And if you are smaller, this is even smaller. So that's why, that's another reason why very small objects below M star are not groups. So in this late redshift, the shock scale and which is comparable to the typical halo or group scale, if you compare the shock hitting scale to the group scale. But at higher redshift, the shock scale is much, much greater than M star, because M star drops very quickly with redshift. And this tells you that you're going to end up, even though you are big above the shock hitting scale, you're going to end up in a single galaxy group, because if you are a very rare perturbation, much above M star, it's unlikely you find a neighbor to merge with and make a group of comparable galaxies, unless you are comparable to M star. So let's remember that at high redshift, you can be big, you can have shock hitting, but you're still going to be a single galaxy halo. How does the clustering affect the streams, or connect to the streams? The idea is that the cold streams survive in isolated galaxies, namely at high redshift, where the shock scale is much bigger than M star, as we said before. But if you put them inside a group, very likely they're going to be harassed, and this will happen mostly for shock scales or above at low redshifts. And again, if we look at the simulation, we see this. We see that right here, even though you are shock heated, about 40% of the gas is still cold streaming. This is the cold stream coming in. And it happens at high redshift, it does not happen at low redshift. And in fact, you can directly look again at another picture from the paper of Keras et al. And ask what is the rate of cold infall versus hot infall as a function of environment density. And you see what one expects. You see that if you are in the field or in a halo which is not grouped, you have cold flows coming in, but once you get into dense groups, you end up with hot medium. So it all comes together, this simple ideas and the simulation. Finally, before I put everything together, this feedback ideas, we talked about supernova feedback, and by some coincidence, it turns out that this is some schematic feedback strength, if you want, as a function of halo mass. And as you can see, it goes down in this rate, roughly. But this is independent of the shock heating, because it has to do with the cooling, but it has to do with the energy of supernova, nuclear energy of supernovae, etc. It's some coincidence that it really goes down at this scale. Well, I won't go into the details. In Dekel and Silk many years ago, and recently revisited by Dekel and Wu, we re-derived the same scale from energetics of supernovae in a burst that you form in a galaxy as a function of the potential well, and we know that below this scale there is not enough energy in the supernovae fed to the gas to make the feedback efficient. So how does this compare? Well, this is a supernova, and again, they coincide roughly at low redshift, the shock hitting scale and the supernova scale. I'll have to rush through this. And this is the fundamental line that's being reproduced by supernova feedback. And go back to what Simon and others discussed earlier, and Volker, the AGN feedback. And the point I want to make is that the energy feedback should be coupled to the gas, and it will have much easier time to be coupled to hot gas. And that's why I think the shock heating is very relevant to the efficiency of the AGN feedback. So the shock heating may be triggering the AGN feedback in the sense that you have enough energy in AGN, we all know that, more than we need. We don't know exactly how it couples to the gas, but if the hot gas is there, if you had shock heating, then you make it vulnerable because it's dilute to AGN feedback. The cold streams can find an easy way to get shielded against this feedback. And this is why the shock heating can trigger the efficiency of the AGN feedback. So the nice thing here is that I don't have time to discuss the other feedback mechanisms, but they all have a minimum around this critical scale. And that's some of this is coincidence, and some of this has to do with the feedback and the shock heating. So let me try to put everything together, all those ingredients, cold versus hot, being in a group or being isolated and having supernova feedback versus AGN feedback. This is working in small objects, this is working in big objects. So the point is that all these three scales, shock heating, supernova, and groups, coincide roughly at low redshifts. And this is what makes the whole thing a very robust imprint in the galaxies we look at. Let me make two wild assumptions. One, when you have cold flows hitting the disk, you make a starburst. And this is just like, the idea is that it's just like a collision of two disk galaxies. The other assumption, if you have a hot medium, it's hot forever. It's going to stop star formation. And the idea is that you have this AGN feedback or some other feedback working on big scales, which very easily couple to the hot medium and dilute and make it go away. With those two assumptions, you make a very nice scenario. You make the blue sequence, and you make the red sequence. And let me show you this in pictures, in kind of color by modality, or H-bound modality, or bulge disk, as a function of halo mass. You have our critical scale at 6 times 10 to the 11 solar masses. Here you have regulated cold gas supply, and then continuous disk in star formation. And you make, naturally, this blue sequence. Until your halo grow above this scale, and then the gas supply stops, you stop disk formation, you stop star formation, and as we saw in the earlier talk, you fade by passive evolution to the red sequence, along which you can grow by gas-poor mergers. Now, let me give you some, first, how it works in the color magnitude, where in color magnitude, you have to move to M star, stellar mass, in this case. And we just argue that this is going to have a maximum near the critical mass. So you're going to move this way and include now satellites inside those halos. And then you move to luminosity. M over L is higher for the red one, so this will affect things. That this is the kind of behavior you expect. This is the kind of bimodality you expect to find. You expect to understand this minimum by the feedback processes. The scale, as we said, is predicted. And then supernova and other feedback mechanisms on small scales produce this, and you can recover the slope here. And what I called shock heating activates the AGN feedback or some other feedback that works on this big scale, and this reproduces what's happening all the way to the cluster. And this explains the same thing here. In particular, this, it can explain the bright end. Let me conclude with two more implications. One, if you take the cold flows and you try to estimate from the cold rate, again from Kerstal, the cold rate infall in time, the blue line, a star formation rate, assume that everything goes through this cold flows. This is the only star formation mechanism. Then you get this, which is already very similar to the drop in the Madaw plot of star formation rate. And a nice thing is that at high redshift, as you can see here, there's a big gap between supernova feedback upper limit and shock heating. This allow a high L over M, if you want, M star over M, at high redshift. So it will give you the best conditions for star formation. This also explains why the Madaw plot has its peak at redshift 1 or 2. The reason is that the typical halos that form at redshift 2 are comparable to the critical mass that we derive from the shock heating. And this can be translated to this. Let me not talk about angular momentum. Let me just show you a new result coming out from one halo in the simulation, in which we show that we find that cold flows typically have higher angular momentum per unit mass than the hot flow. This may explain, or may be very useful in understanding the angular momentum, but this is work in progress. So let me summarize in this way. We have this magic scale in stellar mass and in real mass. Below this, we have cold infall into disks, starbursts, and we find those disks in the field. And the supernova feedback regulates star formation, as we heard today several times. We make blue young population, and we can understand the fundamental line, the way it's formed there. Above this, you remember that long ago, even a big halo was smaller, so most of the stars still formed when cold flows allow the gas to fall in. But then the star formation stops when the halo becomes bigger than the critical mass. You get red and old, and you make spheroidian groups. There's hot gas, and there's some cold flows in isolated galaxies. And finally, the AGN feedback, and this is a generic name for whatever feedback is working at high masses, prevents the cooling of the shock-heated gas. I think my time is gone, right? So this is things to do. Each of these things, some of these I speculated here, needs a lot of work. And this is some recipes how to improve semi-analytic models if you really want to recover the features I was talking about. So this is my summary figure. These are the scales I was talking about. The shock heating scale, I think, is what drives everything. Supernova scale is coinciding with it at low redshift and makes everything stronger, the bimodality. And the fact that the clustering scale is also related to this help us get the environment dependence, okay, in clusters and in the field. So what you end up is you actually make disks here between below 10 to the 10 and 10 to the 12 solar masses. Earlier on, you can make bigger disks, okay, maybe the scuba sources, because these big halos here are not groups. They're much above M star. But later on, these disks enter groups, they become groups, and they must turn into red spheroid. And that's how you get very red objects, very massive red objects at low redshift. And I'll stop here. Thank you.
So for your models, can you understand these sort of top-down trends that you see at very high masses? So above L star, you see the bigger galaxies redder, and they form stars earlier, it seems. Can you understand that in your scenario?
Are you asking how I make big disks?
How do you make the big guys, the ones that are above your critical value, how do you make the bigger ones be redder and form earlier? Right? It seems like we need that.
I'm not sure I understand exactly the question, but let me just repeat the basic point, okay?
Right, there seems to be a top-down trend for big galaxies, right, in their, ages.
Let me repeat what I said to see if expand what you're saying, okay?
No, can I explain why the bigger ellipticals are older?
Can I try to answer your question?
Right.
The blue sequence, if I understand your question, naturally you make, from cold flows, disks below the critical scale, okay? But in some halos, the cold flows continue even when the halo is above the shock heating scale. So you live in this nice picture that Kravtsov showed you, where you have this nice heated halo, hot medium, as well as cold flows. This happens especially in the field, okay, or at high redshift. So especially at high redshift, and especially in isolated halos, you can continue to build the blue sequence over the critical mass, okay? It's only at late redshifts when the shock heating and being in a group kind of coincide. If you are a big halo today, you're probably in a group, and you're also above the shock hitting scale. So you cannot make big disks today, or much less, okay, maybe you make a little bit, but not as you could at redshift 3, and those things from redshift simply turn red and spheroids by today, by mergers, by bar instability, and so on, and they fade away. Because star formation stops in shock-heated halos above the critical scale, especially if you are in a group.
Okay. You're saying the critical scale the filaments is dropping with redshift?
Sorry?
It's dropping with redshift, the critical scale? I thought it was
the
fixed.
Disk scale, the upper limit for disks is dropping in time. Okay? So you could have had bigger disks at redshift 3 than you can today. But fewer, of course, because M star is lower than.
Okay, right. Okay.
I don't think it's necessary to re-engineer any semiolytic models to include the transition between hot flows and cold flows at the transition mass, because it has been included in all semiolytic models since 1989, and in fact you'll find a detailed discussion of it in White and Frank, and there we have a criterion which is the same as yours for the transition, which there we call infall dominated and cooling dominated. And our plots give the dependence on metallicity and redshift of the mass. And this has been included and is responsible for a large part of the behavior. The non-spherical parts, of course, falling in filaments, the existence, coexistence of hot flows and cold flows is, I think, new. But the basic idea, there's a transition in the nature of accretion at this model has been there all the time. I don't think, you know, at the spherical level, what you're saying will change that.
In fact, Simon, what you said today, the model you described today, is already partly re-engineered on top of what people used to do earlier on, in the sense that you introduce the AGN feedback and you try to fix the upper luminosity function. So I'm just trying to give a motivation for the upper feedback and how it connects to the mass with the AGNs by the shock heating allowing the AGN to be effective. But I think that you really want to understand all the scenarios, and I asked you during the talk whether you actually see big forming regions at high redshift, and I guess you simply haven't looked at it yet, or it's worth a very careful look, whether you can produce something like the scuba sources. And I think this kind of scenario does have a very natural way to expand them, as well as the bimodality in the color and so on in the given scale, and the very big elliptical red galaxies at redshift. Now, you may do it with other fixes of the models, and again, in your model you've done some of it. I'm not claiming anything different. I'm just saying that this physics of shock heating with the feedback and the clustering together very naturally give you those fixes that we all understand we need in those models to get those observations right.
No, but my point is that the transition between a cold infall and something with a hot atmosphere was included with, in fact, the criterion in the White and Frank paper is the same within the numerical, except for a change in the numerical coefficient to the one that you derive with Birnbaum, which is a very nice passage. And what we found is when you implement that by itself, it does not produce the bimodality.
No.
It does not switch off the cooling flows. You need an additional effect. And that's why I was talking about the importance of AGN as some additional effect without star formation, which could switch off it.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying, that you want those three features together. You want the AGN feedback on big scales, you need the supernova feedback on smaller scales. I think we are agreeing, I don't know what the argument is. You need the feedback effects, you need the cold versus hot thing to give you the scale, and you need the clustering to follow the clustering scale. And these are the very natural things that come in, if you want it or not. And I'm just saying, if you put them together, there are seeds here to get the bimodality, okay? It's not only the cold versus hot.
Agreed. Not at all. It was included in the way he was done. That doesn't produce the effect. Sorry?
At low masses, you argue that the supernova feedback is important. So what was not clear to me, the way that supernova feedback operates is that basically blow the gas out of the disk, perhaps, or hit it basically above the disk so that it doesn't sit in the disk. Now, if you do hit the gas due to supernova feedback, wouldn't you be able to make a shock then? Because there is hot gas, it's not from... So in other words, if supernova feedback is effective in blowing gas out of the disk, why don't you get
a shock? I didn't try to blow it out. I just said it's just like what Simon said, and I think Volker, mostly to regulate star formation in the disk. This was the main purpose of the supernova feedback here. If you really want the blue sequence and you want the disks to live for a long time along this blue sequence and repeatedly make stars to make them blue, you don't allow just one star formation epoch. You really want to prolong it over many Hubble times. And that's the purpose of the supernova feedback in this case.
I thought the star formation efficiency has to be reduced in low velocity dispersion galaxies. Right?
Exactly. I want to regulate the star formation by the supernova feedback. And it's more and more efficient as you go to lower orbits.
Do you blow the gas out of the galaxy?
If it's very low, yes. If it's dwarf galaxies, yes.
Right. So if you do blow
But I'm really concerned here in this regime here, okay? In this regime, just below L star or below the critical mass, you don't blow the gas out. You blow some of it, but you mostly prevent the star formation to go boom, okay? You just kick a little bit of it out, it may come back, you may get a bursty episodic star formation because of this interaction between gravity and feedback.
Sure, but at lower masses, you do blow it out.
Yeah, but my concern, yeah, this is another talk about how you make dwarf galaxies.
But if you do blow it out, then you would get a shock because there is infalling gas and outflowing gas and they shock.
It's a very interesting problem on this.
Sorry?
It's a complicated problem. It's not a trivial problem, and you and some of it may be relevant.
Well, actually, it's a follow up, so we can continue arguing. So first of all, I think that it's not a coincidence that the two scale for the shock hitting and the supernova are agreeing. In fact, because they are both are tied to the mass of the dark matter halo, which defines both the virial temperature and the escape velocity. So that's why I think they are close.
But there's one ingredient that comes in a supernova, which is the energy that comes out from a supernova.
But according
and this
to
has
your,
nothing to do with shock hitting.
Yeah, but you're doing with spherical explosion, and therefore you are accelerating the mass of the escape velocity of the galaxy. So that where's the mass
no,
of the
but
galaxy?
You agree that if we had stars which produce supernovae that are 10 times more massive, this scale would have been different.
Well, it changes, but not that much. But anyway, so my question was the following. I suppose that now we do agree that metons can only escape from galaxies with masses below that 3 × 10^10 that you're mentioning. But the gas has to leave the galaxy, and we know that from the fact that you're trying to explain the metallicity mass relation. Therefore, that means that the large galaxies are working as a closed box. As you go down, you in fact at 3 × 10^10 in stars, then you start to have your metals ejected,
yep.
And that shows to me that metals can only be ejected from low mass galaxy. I don't know if you can agree on that.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Well, let me just answer this question first, if you don't mind.
I think the whole issue isn't how the accretion rate's changing because of these hot and cold modes. It's the geometry of the flows, right? In the cold mode galaxies, the thing is coming in along filaments. You don't have a hot halo of gas. That naturally explains what you just mentioned. You don't have a hot halo of gas. It's easy for the winds to flow out of the galaxy in every direction, but it's very hard for any kind of supernova feedback to stop the gas from coming into the galaxy. Above that scale, you have the opposite situation. It's very hard for winds to come out, but some kind of feedback process, since it's very spherical accretion, you can imagine it stopping the inflow. And I think that's the difference. It isn't in the semi-analytics at the moment, Simon, even though you can add it in some way.
But Andrea, can I answer?
Yeah.
If you want to explain this trend of metallicity, with mass. The only thing you need, and this is what the simplified model give you, you know, the right slope here of m star to the 0.4, you do it by very naive model, which looks like this, okay? You again recover the result that the supernova energy is proportional to the stellar mass, and which is the key result of our paper then, and you compare it to the binding energy, just energetically, and you end up with this basic relation for what I call the fundamental line, that in those small galaxies where you do blow out things or you heat it up significantly, the stars you form in one burst over the total gas or the halo mass, if you want, that is available, goes like V squared. That's the key result, because then this, with the VL halo relations, end up with this kind of relation. In particular, if you assume what you call the closed box or the instantaneous recycling approximation, you end up with the correct relationship. Now, you may end up getting it with different ways, but this very simplified energetics also reproduces. You don't have to get rid of the gas. It's enough to prevent it from forming stars.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, yes, Avishai, you mentioned that in the cold flow mode for the star formation, that would also lead to starbursts. My question is, in the case, if you look at like the Milky Way, where you have a disk which has been forming stars sort of steadily over 10 to the 10th years, even though I gather this would be from a cold flow, how is that consistent?
I don't know if you'd make a starburst. What I wanted to say, it's going to be very efficient. All the gas that comes in will make stars. Okay. Now, whether it comes as a very nice smooth flow, or whether it comes in clumps, this I don't know. And this, you need high resolution studies of those flows to see actually whether, you know, it's all based on some assumption, because in the simulations of today, you don't have enough resolution to really tell what happens, whether the gas in those flows actually hits the disk or not. Okay, it may be destroyed before that by instabilities. In fact, it's in the SPH simulations, there's some indication for this. But is it real or not? So we don't really know exactly what happens and how the flows go in, whether they're going to hit. But if they come in supersonically and hit the disk, I think you agreed with me that these are conditions for an isothermal shock behind which you'd be very dense, very cold, and genes unstable for star formation. But whether it's best or not, it's all speculation. I don't know.
Okay. I don't know how about you, but I certainly could use some cold info now. So
cold info?
Thanks, all the speakers of the afternoon.